Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
Welcome to Season 3 of the Talking with Traders podcast series with me, Garth McKenzie. Backed by popular demand following the first two seasons, I'll bring you a string of interviews over the next 10 weeks with a number of seasoned traders in my network to give you a first-hand insight into how they trade the world's financial markets so successfully. The first two seasons of this podcast have had over 20,000 downloads of the interviews, so I've used this traction to seek greater global reach for the third season. A special word of thanks must go to our sponsors, IG Markets, for continuing to fund this podcast and to allow it to flourish. In Season 3 of Talking with Traders, I've gone beyond the borders of South Africa to speak to traders from across the globe. I'll ask pertinent questions of each of my guests to really try and get them to open up about what makes them consistently successful when it comes to taking on the world's financial markets. This episode of Talking with Traders takes us to Mauritius, somewhere we haven't been to yet on the series. And our guest today is PJ Sutherland of Sutherland Research. He's an ex-South African who moved to Mauritius a couple of years ago. And I'm really looking forward to speaking to you, PJ. Welcome to Talking with Traders.
Oh, God, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. And, you know, we go some way back, and I've always respected you as a trader. So to be sharing this platform with you is great. And I might also add that I think what you're doing here is fantastic. You know, any information we can get out in terms of our industry is a good thing. So well done for that.
Well, thank you. And thanks for agreeing to participate. So, PJ, let's go right back to the beginning of your career. What got you interested in trading in the early years, and what sort of path has your career followed since then?
Sure. So, Garth, I've been trading for about 15 years, and it was really by accident that I ended up in the markets. I never intended to trade, and I wasn't very familiar with the financial markets. In fact, none of my family traded. I was involved in a family business, property business. And this is back in the sort of 03 to 08 era. If you recall, there was a big bull market in markets around the world, but also the property market, especially in South Africa. So I'd done kind of well through that era in property and was looking actively to invest some excess cash I had. And naturally, one then sort of arrives at the market and came across a person that was trading the market, had an interesting system, showed it to me, and I then got caught initially from day one. It sort of captured my heart. So I invested in the system, and off I went. And I think if I recall, it was a really very simple technical system. It involved a stochastic. So the stochastics had to drop below 20. You would then go in and buy, and then pop above 20, and you'd sell. And so off I went. I started first three trades with winners, which is, you know, the worst thing that can happen to one, because you start doing all the numbers and you're going to retire on your island. But very soon thereafter, we were confronted with some shorts, you know, popping above 90 in shorts, and within days I've blown up my account. And so that would deter most people, but really that at that time I knew this was something I wanted to do. It appealed to my analytical mind. It appealed to the risk-seeking nature that I have. And it appealed to, I think, a greater sense of this intellectual puzzle that one would look to solve. And so from there, you know, went out. I'd actually sold a portion of business and had enough capital to own my house and keep going. And so I went into this full time and really struggled initially. You know, the first 3 years or so, I didn't find any enormous success. It was all subjective. I read, as most would, a whole bunch of books. I completed the Chartered Market Technician program. And by all accounts, had some skill, but couldn't replicate that skill in the marketplace. And it was at that point that I sort of realized I wasn't ever going to be a great subjective trader. And that's what led me to a much more mechanical approach. And that started then the journey down what has really come to be known as quantitative finance. And so started testing models, you know, went quite far down the road in terms of retail platforms, hit walls there, ended up actually doing a BSc in computer science to improve those programming skills. And then ultimately got to a point where I started to see some consistency and started to develop a framework But really, I used to this day, and still evolving, still learning, and through that, I've released two platforms that end users can employ to manage their own accounts. And we have some family offices and a small hedge fund involved, and that kind of brings me up to where I am today.
That's interesting. Okay, and you mentioned that it was difficult in the first couple of years, and you said you realized quite early on that you were going to struggle with a subjective trading system. So that's interesting, and that really talks to the psychology of trading, which I think is
absolutely
it's incredibly important. I mean, you and I both know this as traders. Psychology is probably 80 or 90% of the game. Your method, what you do, how you choose your entries and exits and all of that is all one. It's all wonderful and it's important, but it's actually psychologically, it's really where the game is at, and your success or failure as a trader has far more to do with your psychological ability to handle the ups and downs
than anything else.
Now, 100% so agree. From that perspective, you then mentioned that you've gone into what you call a quantitative finance. Is that right? Quantitative finance approach.
Exactly.
You've got some programming skills. You run two different trading platforms. But can you give us a little bit of insight into what your trading strategy is nowadays? Because I think knowing you as I do, and also having chatted to other traders and what have you, your approach seems to revolve mostly around mean reversion, which is quite different to a lot of the other traders that we've spoken to. But tell me a bit more about your trading strategy. I'm very interested to hear about it.
Sure, with pleasure. So I've spent a lot of time, in fact, trading most styles. So momentum, I've done a whole bunch of pairs, arbitrage, etc. But really zeroed in on mean reversion. It's quite ironic because when I first started, that very simple system that I referred to earlier, the stochastics, that really ultimately is a mean reversion type strategy. And so what drew me to mean reversion is it's short-term in nature, so we're exploiting short-term mean reversion. The average holds are anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And in essence, what you're looking to do is you're waiting for a stock to encounter strong moves in one direction, and typically that's driven by news flow, so it could be going up or down. And then you're looking to take a position counter to that in anticipation of a move in the other direction, which would be a reversion to the mean. And so that type of approach lends itself pretty well to all sorts of statistical analysis. And the reason for that is you get quite a lot of trades out of a back test, because you're typically holding for short periods. You can test a lot across lots of counters and arrive at a database that has numerous trades, and those tend to be statistically more significant. But one of the great upshoots of mean reversion is they enjoy high win rates. So you can see win rates as high as 70, even 80%. And you've mentioned psychology, and 100% agree with you. Psychology, I think, almost is everything in this game. Early on, I didn't believe that. And so if you, for example, trading a typical trend following or momentum strategy where your win rates are 30, 40%, psychologically, those are much more challenging to endure. And if you flip that around, you've got the mean reversion profile where you're seeing win rates of 70, 80%. Psychologically, they're much easier to handle through time. And so those were the draw cards. Of course, with every approach, they're dark sides, and one needs to make sure you understand what they are and how to control them. But that's what drew me to mean reversion. And in fact, the last 10 years, I focused almost exclusively researching mean reversion as an anomaly across the global markets.
It's very interesting. So now, I mean, you're really looking for moves that are outside of the mean, of course. What is that? One standard deviation, two, three standard deviations from any given mean?
Sure. So, I mean, that is the starting point. You need to define a mean. And so there are many, many ways you could do that. A very simple example would be a moving average. And as you've referred, you could be a couple standard deviations away. So you could have a 10-day moving average, and you need to be 2, 3 standard deviations away before you consider entering. You could use volatility to measure that deviation. You could use even static measures. But there are other ways. I mean, you could look at, for example, any of the oscillators. If you think of relative strength index, it ranges between 0 and 100, or 50 could be your mean. And then you're looking for price to trigger the extreme. So shorts would be above 90 and longs below 10. And then you would look for a bounce back to the mean, which then would be, of course, 50. You could look at stochastics, this rate of change. In fact, the method you use is not entirely the most important component. There are many ways to capture it. What is important, of course, is how you execute your trades and how you manage your risk.
Well, that's it, exactly. And that was going to be my next question to you, because with this type of trading strategy, obviously you are fading those moves away from the mean, which, as you say, it'll give you a 70 to 80% win rate. But the question is, what about that 20 or 30% of the time where it continues to move away from the mean significantly? And, yes. And there must be times where you've seen that situation where the stock moves two or three standard deviations, but then for some or other reason, it's maybe news related, probably is invariably news related, you see a stock that just continues to move far and further away from the mean. So you know, I suppose the questions I want to ask you is, how do you manage that risk? And then second of all, what kind of position sizes do you take when you trade these mean reversion trades?
Sure. So, and that sort of risk you referred to there, Garth, is known in the industry as tail risk. And that's that risk. It really is the dark side of mean reversion. You know, it works 9 out of 10 times. And then the 10% where you kind of have that elastic band that's stretching and snaps and moves very strongly against you. That's the profile of mean reversion that's challenging and one really needs to focus on. So it's news flow that drives all these edges. You're really waiting for a significant move. And oftentimes, investors overreact to that news. That's what creates this anomaly. They get overexcited to the upside or too fearful to the downside. So they push these prices to temporary extremes. But the catch is some of the time that emotion is justified. And for instance, a company could be going bankrupt or a fraud's uncovered. And there's just no hope of a reversion. So then your question is, you know, how do you manage that risk? And quite simply, the first approach is, you need to position size yourself to allow for that risk. And so what is quite typical in the momentum or trend following world is to use a stop loss. And that actually perfectly reconciles with the thesis of momentum. You're buying strength and hope that strength will continue. If you don't see the strength, it's perfectly sensible to close out your trade. Mean reversion is quite different because our thesis is price is moving low if you're thinking of a long trade. And if you enter and it continues to move low, really then your thesis is saying it's become a stronger buy. And so with this type of approach, we actually don't use stop losses, which flies obviously in the face of convention, but typically when you do that, you're doing something right. And these are not opinions, these are really derived on data. So if you test these models out and you implement stop losses, they simply don't work. And the reason for that is, they capture too many trades that ultimately do end up mean reverting and providing profit. So they effectively become almost a negative profit stop. So they're locking the loss of a trade. So that's not the way you want to handle that. And in fact, when you include a stop loss, you really start to move back to a trend following momentum type performance profile. And so the question is, well, how do you deal with this? Well, a simple way is when you test these models out, and you're hoping to test them on really big databases. So, you know, we run our models on 50,000 securities from the global financial market. So we have hundreds of thousands, often millions of trades. You can then examine the distributions of trade returns from all those trades. And specifically, you're interested in the tails. Those are the extremes, the extreme losses or the extreme gains, although that would be more for profit stopping, profit stops or obviously short trades, losses. And from there, you can then set a position size that appropriately allows for that type of loss or sequence of losses across a number of counters in future. And then, of course, build a buffer into that to allow for those extremes to be breached. So that's the first thing. The next thing is when you build a mean reversion model, and in fact, this actually applies to all models, what a lot of traders do is they will zero in on a single parameter set. So let's think of our example here. Of relative strength. So it drops below 20 or 10, that's your trigger to buy. What a lot of traders will do is they'll go in and allocate 100% of their capital to that entry point, and then they'll have one exit point. And what you're doing there is you're subjecting yourself to a lot of luck, because those parameter combinations will ultimately not always be in sync with the data. They won't always work. And so the approach we employ, and one that works really well, is we cut our capital allocations up and spread them across what are called the parameter universe. And so you would have little entries that are starting to take place at, let's say, 30 on your RSI, at 20, at 10, and you work them all the way down. And you do the same on your exit. So you take profits early on, and as the move intensified in your favor, you will take additional profits. And what you effectively do then is you capture the average trade through time, and you diversify yourself across what I call the mean reversion curve. And this is a much more effective way to control risk. So you position size, of course, for the a very big loss in future, but you also allocate your capital wisely across the trade. You don't just go into a single entry point or a single exit point. And together that works very well. And then overlays, in addition to that, is tail risk hedging strategies. So these wouldn't be available on the JSE, but in the US, there are lots of volatility products that you can trade through ETFs. And these, you simply include a sort of trend following momentum type model on those, and they would capture all big volatility explosions. And typically those are the ones that suck the entire market in, and you see those correlation ones. And if you have a sort of 3 to 5% exposure to those, they work very well. And the coronavirus sell-off is a case, point in case, or case in point. We had some allocations to volatility, and some of those products went up, 600-800% in a very short space of time. So that's also a very effective way to mitigate the risk. But I think ultimately it's also an allocation thing to the strategy as a whole. In a great scheme of things, you would only allocate a certain percent of your portfolio to mean reversion, and then you'd hope to have some momentum and other ideas as well. And I think if you do that in full, you're doing a pretty good job of controlling risk.
So PJ, if I understand you correctly, what you're saying then is if you're talking about your relative strength index where it drops from 30 to 20 to 10, and you're adding into the trade the whole time on the way down, what you're effectively doing then is adding to a trade that's losing you money at the time. So doesn't that go in a fly in the face of one of those cardinal rules of trading that you should never add to a loser?
Sure. So, and that is a rule that we abide by. It's not something you want to do. You don't want to go out and add to losers. What you're instead doing, Garth, is you're acknowledging that there's a lot of luck involved in trading. And anyone who says otherwise is in denial. So there are different ways. We're managing risk here, but we're also in part managing the element of chance. So if you think about an entry point, what typical traders will do is they'll allocate 1% or 5%, whatever the allocation is, and they'll bet that entire allocation on their one entry point. Essentially, they go all in on that entry point, and they'll do the same with the exit point. And when you test these models out, you find that parameters are not stable through time. And the parameter here would be, for example, our RSI at 30 is one parameter, and RSI at 20 is another. So there's a whole bunch all the way down to close to zero. And so any of those parameters can be relatively lucky or unlucky at a given point in time, especially relating to a single stock and market environment. And the same holds for the exit point. You don't actually know where the recovery will end. And so to go in and bet your entire stake on one entry point and exit point will ultimately lead to real-time performance that no way coincides with your expectations from the past. So we are in turn controlling chance here as well, in addition to risk. So when you start to allocate across what's called, the sort of entry parameter set, you capture the average entry price, and that is much more robust and stable through time. And when you exit across the exit parameter set, you're also capturing a much more robust exit condition. And in fact, when you test these models and then you go and trade them live, the probability of realizing results that very closely resemble those that you've tested is much, much higher. And in fact, when you do this long enough, it's really about predictability. How confident are you about replicating these results going live? And this goes a long way in achieving that.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, then what you're really saying is that you're not really averaging down into a trade, in the sense you've actually decided up front what your maximum allocation to a position is going to be, and your execution of that trade is simply to try and buy it through the bottom of the dip and ultimately achieve an average entry price that is sufficiently far away enough from the mean that you then capitalize on the price snapping back and moving back towards the mean ultimately.
That's exactly right, Garth. And I mean, you can go quite far down the rabbit hole here, because you can take that allocation And then you can start to tail weight it, which would, you know, go against the cardinal rule of not adding to losses. But we know our allocation up ahead of time. So, for example, if your allocation to any one trade is, let's say, 2% of equity, then you could break that up into, I'll enter initial stake, 20% of that 2%, then 30%, and the final stake at 50%. And what happens is you actually start to have this tail weighting effect, which pulls your entry price further down as the move intensifies. So that's one interesting technique that can be added. And there are lots of variations around that.
And the next question is then, once you've got your entry, so you've been adding on the way down, do you then also start to add on the way up as well?
So we'll look to exit them on the way up. So we won't add to the position on the way up, because our thesis then is fulfilling itself. We've had the reversion, and the probability of returns following that resembling those in the market are much higher. So our edge in the market persists for about 5 to 10 days, and with a sweet spot of around 3 days. So when you start to approach 10 days, you really just move to the market return. And of course, we're hoping to capture return greater than the market return.
Right. Okay. Now, the next question, of course, is then around that risk again. It's all very well, like you said, this works 70 to 80% of the time. There are going to be those times where you're averaging in, and you've got your full allocation to the trade. Now, presumably, you've obviously now stopped buying at this point, but the price continues to move against you. So let's just think, for example, a Hammerson recently, or a Steinhoff, which everybody will be familiar with, you know, where clearly the price just continues to move against you and against you and against you, irrespective of how far away it is from the mean. At what point do you then call it quits and say, okay, well, this trade isn't working for us, we have to cut the loss? And is there a fixed sort of amount of capital that you are allowed to lose on a trade like that? Or is it, or do you sort of feel it out on each individual situation?
You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider. If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes.
No, so I think upfront you need to decide how much risk you're willing to take if these things go to zero, and you should be comfortable with that, although that's a very low probability event. But what's much more important than that is selecting the universe that you decide to trade in. So to answer your question, there are no stop losses. If you're going to use a stop loss, then a catastrophic type stop loss works well at about 50%. So when a stock's lost 50%, then the trade return stream and drawdown aren't too badly affected. If you go and implement stop losses of 10, even 20%, you'll double drawdown and halve return stream. So it's not something that works. We could implement a systems-wide stop loss or catastrophic stop loss, but we don't employ any of those. And the reason for that is we focus on very specific trade universe. Now, if you think about mean reversion, as we alluded to earlier, the biggest risk to us is tail risk. That's what you're talking about now. That's the probability that these stocks just keep going in one direction against us. The probability of encountering those types of moves is much, much higher in the small cap space. In fact, it's so high that mean reversion starts to break down and you're really better off applying some sort of trend following model. And the mid cap universe, it's still relatively risky. So the probability of encountering those types of moves increases. When you start to move into the high cap and ultra high cap space, the probability of Apple seeing, you know, 30-day down move without any intraday pop is highly unlikely. There are just so many players involved. You have all your speculators, your hedges, your intraday guys of high frequency. And so the probabilities, although in theory you can see it go all the way to zero, in theory you'll find that there's enough volatility on the way down for an exit point. And so we would just wait for some reversion. And typically, that can be as small as a brief intraday pop to the upside that would take us out. But there are painful trades because they tend to be held a much, much longer than your winners. The winners just work you in and it reverts and you out. The losses can work against you. And in fact, of course, some of my worst trades did precisely that. So it's the universe that's important, and then the position sizing that you're willing to put on and expect, you know, possibly one of these to go to zero. And then very importantly, multiple entry and exit points along the way. So some would be very close to market, some would be a bit further. And that almost guarantees that you're relieving or unwinding exposure as the move unfolds.
Right. And when you talk about position size, you know, you've got about what, $4.5 million that you manage at the moment. Is that right?
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
So in terms of that $4.5 million, I mean, what's the maximum then that you would allocate to one individual position?
Sure. So, I mean, if you think, well, one of the family offices will be a good example. They trade $1 million through the platform. So their starting point is, and I'm just going to chat about the US here, but it's the same process on the JSE. We have strategies that trade the top 2,000 most liquid counters, the top 1,500, the top 1,000, and the top 750. So strategies are spread across all those universes. The top 750 obviously are large cap counters, so we put on quite a bit more risk there. And then as you spread out into you know, the top 2,000 where they're less liquid, we put on less risk. And so these types of accounts will trade strategies in all those universes, and each of those models will put on different types of position sizes. So they're not all equivalent. But if you look at the portfolio from a high level, I was in fact just looking at it now, the position size per individual counter on the whole, when you've included all the models, they're 90 in this particular account. That is about 0.33%. So they're in fact very, very small position sizes. But keep in mind, you could have a number of those in the same position, so they could increase. And how far you're willing to go with that is really dictated by your criteria and your objective. You know, a pension fund that cannot withstand drawdowns exceeding 10% would demand a very different position size as opposed to leveraged PJ, who is happy to have 30% drawdown. So it is individual and it is very customized to the client's objectives.
Okay, so that I think maybe also leads to my next question is, do you take leverage? But I think you've kind of answered that. But sometimes yes and sometimes no.
It's very modest. So in the US, we in theory are allowed to gain leverage of 2x. But in reality, we seldom see above 1. So probably 80, 90% of the time, no leverage. And then we'll have these spikes where they go out to about 1.5x. That's the same pretty much on the JSE. So we are willing to put some leverage on when we present it with an abundance of opportunity. But as you know, Garth, it works both ways, and anything much beyond 2, personally, I think is suicide in the market.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I struggle to sleep well at night if I've ever got more than 1.5 to 2x leverage on my account at any one time. And I suppose that also comes with age. Maybe we've worn enough scars earlier on in our careers to know that when you go to bed with 3, 4, 5x leverage, you can wake up very unhappy the next morning sometimes.
Well, I think, you know, any type of mastery in any field requires making all the painful mistakes.
Yes.
I can say I've made all those mistakes. I've been around the block. You know, I've done the 3, 4, 5x leverage. And invariably, it's uncomfortable to trade, but ultimately you're caught with something that does your 50% move and takes you out. So, 100% agree.
Yeah. The next question then is, with the strategy, I mean, we've spoken about it in terms of buying and looking to buy the aggressive moves to the downside, away from the mean, etc. But do you use the same strategy on the short side as well?
That's an interesting question. And shorts and longs are actually don't behave the same way. For the most part, they do. But, you know, fear is a much more powerful emotion. We're exploiting, you know, it's all based on behavioral finance. So we're exploiting human emotion, and fear is a very powerful emotion. Bottoms are actually quite easy to uncover. If you look at any one chart, they're last. I mean, if you think of big bottoms in the market, typically you've got a week to be a buyer at a bottom. Tops are very different. You know, it's very hard to find any indicator or algorithm that can isolate every top in the market, because greed is just not as powerful as fear. In fact, there's something called prospect theory, which was developed by Kahneman. He won a Nobel Prize for his work in behavioral finance. And he's proven that a loss to us has twice the effect on us as the same size gain. So losing is very hard, and you have to deal with models on the long side quite differently. Typically, a lot of the tail risk resides in the long side. You just need to think of coronavirus. So you need overlays in there that protect for it. And oftentimes they're quite a bit more rewarding because there are assets that are held by these companies. So you have this big boost to the downside and then you tend to see good recoveries. Now, on the short side, returns aren't as great. In fact, they're probably about half of what you'll see from the long side. And to uncover them, typically you're going to hold out a little bit longer than a long trade. So you'll want to see the stock trend for some time before you'll consider putting on shorts. And so there are subtle differences, but for the most part, the algorithms are really quite similar. And I love seeing that when I test models because it does point to very strong robustness. It's difficult to find a set of rules that you can just reverse from long to short and see similar performance, but ours are pretty close to that by some minor changes.
Yeah. And a classic example recently, I guess, has got to be Tesla, where that stock's just gone up and up and it's squeezed all of the shorts out. And it's moved very far from the mean, but it's just continued to go higher and higher as the shorts have been squeezed further and further. And yes, eventually the price did crack and it did drop by about, I don't know, 20 or 30% quite quickly. Sure. But boy, oh boy, if you had been too early on that short, you were absolutely carried out as that price spiked up into the stratosphere.
Well, that's right. And I think that's a problem for a lot of short traders. I mean, if you think of The Big Short, you probably watched that movie.
Yeah.
The final year, you had to hang on to those positions of losing investors. You know, it really does. It's not an easy thing to do in the market. And as a whole, I think markets have a much stronger tendency to rise over the long term. You know, companies are actively trying to make profits. The central banks support markets, etc. So because of that, it does make sense to make lower allocations to the short end if we're uncomfortable with those sorts of moves.
Yeah. Now, something else, PJ, just to veer away slightly from this topic, is the time frame you're talking about. You mentioned that your holding time is typically 3 to 5 days on any given trade. And within that sure. time, you've got your result. But the strategy that you're referring to is also quite kind of unique in that you don't necessarily get these types of spikes away from the mean every single day. So how often do you enter a trade? I mean, how many, I don't know, in an average year or an average month, how many trades does your strategy give you over the course of, let's say, over a year?
Well, again, it depends on account size, but, and I guess just taking a step back, that's one element of the approach that really is quite appealing. Is the fact that we do spend so much time in cash. Cash is actually, well, especially in South Africa, an important component of the return stream. We can spend as much as 85, 90% of our time in cash, and then we'll go in and allocate funds when the edges present themselves. So you can certainly go through periods where you're not being active, and then suddenly there's a flurry of activity. Now, depending on account size, you know, if you're looking in the US, $1 million type account, you'll be doing 1,000 trades a month. So really a lot of trades. On the JSE, R1 million type sized account, we'd probably be doing 100 to 300 trades in a month, depending on the risk profile that the client's chosen. Now, a lot of those trades are not, remember, unique. You could have a single stock that's moved aggressively to the downside, and each little entry point would be considered a trade through that move. And so those obviously contribute to the trade count, but you could, I guess, step back and say it was really one trade in one stock.
Yeah, okay. I guess that's the question, really, is that because you're right. If you've entered 100 times, but you've gone in a, you know, it's still one stock and it's one position and one effectively one big trade. That's I suppose what I'm trying to get at.
Exactly.
Because also in what you're talking about, and I love this. You say you're in cash 85 to 90% of the time, and you know, what I've often said to my clients is that you want to almost trade the way that a leopard hunts, and we know that a leopard is a far more successful hunter than a lion. A lion goes after a lot of prey and doesn't catch much of it, whereas a leopard is very, very selective. It'll only make the attack when it's certain of getting a result. And
precisely.
So what you're doing is exactly that type of approach. You trade like a leopard rather than a lion.
Well, exactly. You want to get involved in the market when the money's lying on the floor. You walk over and pick it up. But it's much more than that, Garth. This is actually supported by really a lot of extensive testing. So if you look at the market as a whole, in the short term specifically, 90% of the time it really is and really does move more or less randomly, which gets all these efficient market hypothesis guys so excited. It really does resemble a bell curve to a large extent. But every so often, you find that that starts to break down when irrationality enters the marketplace. So market participants are mostly rational, and then a big dose of news will hit the market and they start to become a little bit irrational, which is why this year's actually in the US been one of our best years. There's a lot of volatility, a lot of irrationality around. And you only really want to get involved when those edges are in your favor. For the most part, they aren't, despite what others will say.
Fascinating. It's just such an interesting conversation. I mean, we are running short of time, but I'm going to push this interview out a little bit longer because I'm really enjoying what you're saying. And I think the listeners are probably likely to find this very interesting as well. Something I've asked all of the guests on this podcast series is around their best trade and worst trades. And most of us in the market have a story or some memorable trades that are either best or worst trades. So let's start with your worst trade. What was your worst trade and how did that happen?
So, you know, I think through time now, you know, I've been actively trading these for well over 10 years. So, you know, I think we've probably tallied up, you know, hundreds of thousands of trades, possibly even millions. So it's been quite a unique position in the sense that we trade in the short term. So there have been a lot of painful trades and obviously a lot of good trades along the way. But certainly, I would say my best trade would have to be in South Africa, the resource sector. In fact, the worst trade as well. That's our volatile sector. And we had loaded up very, very heavily into resources across the entire resource sector almost. And some news came out. I can't recall exactly what it was, but the following morning, they all popped 20% to the upside. And we just had such an incredible windfall in gains. And those don't happen often, but when they do, they're great fun.
Okay. Fantastic. And yeah, carrying on, what was the next
one? And then the worst, if you're wanting to hear the worst, would have to be actually last year on the JSC. I don't know if you recall, Palladium enjoyed an enormous bull run to the upside. Implats obviously did very well out of that. And a lot of the deep value funds in South Africa that hadn't done well for extended period captured that move. We went short that move and it resulted in our worst drawdown to date. I think it was around negative 18% as a group. And it was one of those moves, Garth, that we were sort of talking about earlier, the tail move that just simply doesn't reverse. And I think it went on for 18 trade days. So, you know, a month of watching the position move against you. And that was really very challenging. But outside of that, there have been a number of other very similar experiences. And your position size really determines how impacted you are by those sorts of moves. If you're very impacted, then generally you're just trading too big and you need to downsize a bit, which we were doing.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it always comes back to your risk management, doesn't it? Any disaster in the market invariably comes back to some sort of risk management failure if your position's too big or you don't have a point at which you call it quits. So I guess that...
It's everything. If you take your eye off risk, it will set its eye on you. And early on, I think we all probably do a fair bit of exploring that ourselves. But you learn sooner or later through humility that it really is the game we risk managers after all. It's the one thing we can control. And longevity at this game really is explained by showing up every day. And the only way you can do that is through controlling risk.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. PJ, what advice would you give to someone that was youngster coming into the market now? You mentioned that you got into this industry kind of by accident, but if you were a youngster, you know, you're 20 years old or 18 years old, you want to get involved in the markets. What advice would you give to some youngster coming through now?
Well, I think for starters, Garth, there's probably a lot of misleading information out there. You know, brokers claiming all sorts of quick profits, charlatans, etc., and nothing could be further from the truth. So I think you really need to have some grounding in terms of expectation, because otherwise you'll just whittle and die before you start. It really is a tough game, and it's becoming tougher. And the people you're competing against out there are extremely well qualified. They spend a lot of time analyzing markets and have access to funding and all sorts of things. And these are the people that are on the other side of your trade. And so you want to be sure to ground yourself in quite a tough journey initially. I mean, I personally don't know anyone that just goes out and makes a bunch of money. Generally, it's going to be a 3 to 5 year process before you find your feet. So I think in today's age, I think a bare minimum of sort of bachelor's, computer science, mathematics, one of those fields, and certainly some time in the programming world, it's all moving that way, and you really need to rigorously test your ideas. I think technical analysis as well is starting to become more rigorous, and things you can't prove are going to fall by the wayside. And once you've got that all under your belt, then I think, your 10,000 hour rule, 5 to 10 years, you're probably going to have your first little models that are working. And from there, you'll grow and evolve and create your unique edge. But certainly, you need to ask yourself, how passionate are you about the markets? And I know without a shadow of doubt, without the passion I have for the markets, I would have stopped a long time ago. It's the only thing that keeps you going in this business, because you will face drawdown, you will face failure, and you will face loss. And to get up after those episodes is challenging without a good dose of passion.
Yeah, passion is such a big thing. And I think not only trading, I think in anything in life, if you're passionate about what you do, you're going to do it well. It's what drives you to keep going when the times get tough. And certainly this business does dish out tough times from time to time. And then second last question for you, PJ, is regarding books. Do you do a lot of reading? Have you done a lot of reading of trading books in your career? And if so, sure. Do you have 2 or 3 books that you could recommend that you think are a must read for anybody listening to this podcast?
Well, I think like most of us, when you start, you go out on a reading binge. So I certainly have read my fair share of trading books, and through that would definitely recommend, all the Jack Schrager Market Wizards. I love those. Way of the Turtle by Curtis Faith, I think, is a fantastic book. Van Tharp, there were a bunch, but certainly I think the Market Wizards, if you're going to read anything, those are great. Outside of that, I think nowadays, I don't actually read much. I've got the testing infrastructure, I have a relatively good understanding of how markets work, so I mostly spend my time researching the markets through insights daily observed and through performance from existing models.
Okay. Interesting that you mentioned Jack Schrager and Market Wizard series. Those books have come up in many of these interviews, and he's actually coming up with a new book. It's called Anonymous Market Wizards, or Market Wizards You've Never Heard Of, or something along
That's
those
right.
lines.
But exactly.
Anyway,
yeah.
He's been tweeting it out quite a lot lately, and I've actually put myself on the list to get a copy of it on the audiobook the moment that it's published. It's due to come out on the 3rd of November. So, you might find that interesting. And I'm sure anyone else listening to this podcast will also probably find that book very, very interesting. I'm certainly looking forward to it being published.
I've got my eye on it too. So absolutely.
Yeah. Last question then for you, PJ. You mentioned, obviously, you manage money for family offices and others. If someone wanted to get in contact with you to invest in to give you some money to manage based on the strategy that you very eloquently told us about in this interview, how can they do that?
Well, very easily, southernresearch.com is our website, so they can find me on there. And you also find the detail of the platforms that are on offer. There's a blog on there that I put together every month or so, and there's a newsletter where I release all sorts of interesting things. And there's some demos available as well if you want to give those a free trial. And I think just to be clear, Garth, I don't, in fact, manage the funds on behalf of clients. They get access to the platform, and through the platform, you're able to very easily engineer, test, trade, and implement automatically a portfolio in the market. So my job is to ensure that you understand the research that drives the platform, and then ultimately how to use the platform. And then from there, you would do your own thing.
Okay, super. Thanks for making that clear to us. And yeah, regarding your blog, I mean, I subscribe to it and I receive it every month. I thoroughly enjoy reading it. It's a nice, short, quick read. It's easy to digest. And anyone listening to this podcast that is really interested in markets and is keen to follow PJ's work, I suggest subscribing to that blog. It's well worth it. And as you said, SutherlandResearch.com is your website. That's it for this interview, PJ. Thank you so much for joining me. It's really been an absolute pleasure talking to you. We've gone a little bit over time, but I think it's well worth it. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to speaking to you again at some stage in the future and keeping in touch.
God, thank you. It's really been fun, and well done on putting this together. It's great work, and I'm sure your listeners are getting a lot of value out of this. So thank you for having me on your show.
Super. Thanks, and you stay well.
You too. Cheers, guys.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.